The Words We Live By. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present the 14th in this series of 15 literary dialogues on democracy and the Bible, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Mark, something you said in our last talk has been haunting me. I want to go back to it. It's possible I didn't understand you, or it's possible our listeners will misunderstand you. You were speaking of war and your horror of war, apart from the particular form and threat that has taken on now. And you were saying that you knew men, as all of us do, who remember the Second World War, some even the First World War, with glee and with nostalgia of what a marvelous time they had. This was the high point of their lives. Then you went on to speak of some notion of conflict or of stress between human beings as constituting a necessary and indispensable ingredient of human relations. And there stayed in my mind the notion, not that you would feel it, but that it would convey to others an echo of a combative outlook on human relations. So I want to go back and get a sort of reassurance or a restatement from you that no such misunderstanding should get through to others.
Well, combative is a word that I didn't use. I used words such as strife and competition and so on, and struggle. I was only referring to what to me is the fact that what makes life vibrate, what makes life, in other words, continuously interesting, is some kind of continuous conflict within oneself, for instance. The struggle between one's better and one's worse nature, or one's lazier and one's more industrious nature, between one's more intelligent, one's more stupid nature. But I'm thinking of contests of all sorts, all the little contests that go on perpetually in the world, athletic contests, if you please, contests of poets for prizes, contests of students to see who will be valedictorian in their class. I can't think of all the forms of this that there are, because they tend to be infinite. There's a contest in any good conversation. Well, there's a contest, by the way, if I may say so, between you and me in these conversations.
Well,
one of us trying to get a word in.
Ah, but what we're doing is something else, Mark. We are trying to elicit from each other the maximum. In this contest, this is the way I feel. I know you feel about it. I am as delighted when you hit upon a good idea as you are when I hit upon a good idea, or when you think I've hit upon a good idea.
Well, so among all these contests of us,
there is this problem of competition on which I've spent a lot of time trying to worry out what I consider the proper attitude. The one toward which biblical philosophy tends. There may be something in the notion that poets should write anonymously. The delight of producing the poetry should be so much of a reward in itself that wanting to be known as the poet, and heaven knows neither you nor I have reached that stage of clarification in which we're indifferent to people's knowledge of our achievements, that reaching a stage where the mere production of it is so satisfying that the struggle is essentially with the form and with the recalcitrance of the material that we are dealing with, and not with the world seeking to gain its attention.
Well, now there you used a word yourself, which is exactly consonant with what I've been talking about. The artist struggles with his material. There's a kind of war between him and his material.
Yes.
The material refuses to take form, and he refuses to desist from trying to put form there where there isn't form, because, you know, there's no form in life. The artist puts it there. That's the sort of thing exactly that I'm talking about.
There is a passage in the Pirkei Avot in the Ethics of the Fathers, one of the most beloved books Talmud, or of the Mishneh core of the Talmud, in which we are told, thou must not make of the Torah, and Torah there meant all learning, thou must not make of the Torah a crown to glory in or a spade to dig with. The joy should be intrinsic. But in...
Incidentally, I have said in print myself that the deepest satisfaction that an artist could possibly have might be the satisfaction of knowing that a song he wrote, a poem he wrote, a story he told, now was going around the world and would go around forever, and no one would know who wrote it.
That's a lovely thing.
I'm sure, by the way, that's the ultimate fame.
A strange thing happened.
And yet it isn't among, fame at all.
Among the other horrors of the Nazi time in Germany, they couldn't get the people to stop singing the Lorelei song when they passed the rock of the Lorelei on the Rhine.
Yeah.
Have you been down the Rhine?
No, I never
There's a rock there, and when the boat passes that point, quite instinctively, automatically, the people stand up and sing that famous song, Ich weiß nicht, was alles bedeuten, you know, that Lorelei song.
Heine.
By Heine. They couldn't get the people to stop singing it, so they had to put the book in the anthologies, and they put underneath author unknown. They eliminated his name.
Yes.
So they sanctified, if you like, Heine by making him that anonymous voice of the people. Let me get back again to this. To me, the horrible subject or the horrible reality of a combative impulse in man, I can't call it instinct, that would be too technical and precise a word, impulse that exists everywhere to get the better of somebody else. And the joy that men have in battle with each other for the purpose of getting on top of the other man. And there are no end to the poetry that's been written and the purple prose passages in the glorification of war. You remember in Tennyson's Ulysses, to drink delight of battle with my peers far on the ringing plains of windy Troy. I actually wonder whether this isn't sheer sentimentalization, that at that time they were thinking, I wish I were home beside a cozy fire, all this cold and mess. Or do they actually go at it and one says, hooray, I just lopped off one of his ears. Isn't that marvelous? Hooray, I've just lost a couple of fingers. Let's go. Is that what they were doing?
Well, what I was saying the other day about those men who enjoyed their memories of wars and think that the wars they were in were the most interesting portions of their lives, when I was talking about that, I should have remarked that those men who were wounded are those men who have now become, say, paraplegic, probably have no sentimental preference for the state of war. We tend to forget those men. We listen to the survivors, the men who perhaps were not involved at all, really involved at all.
I remember a book...
Who were taking a kind of vacation.
I remember a book I read many years ago, Les Croix de Bois, by a Frenchman. I don't think it's appeared in English. A man called Roland Dorgelez, in which he talks of the men who come out of the trenches. He describes their having been there for something like 36 or 48 hours, utterly sick and miserable, longing to escape. Then they're marched out, they're relieved by another regiment, and as they march through the village, they perk up, and they begin to march in unison. Their shoulders are back, and one of them shouts out joyously, c'est nous qui avons tenu les tranchées là-bas. It is we who kept the trenches there. Now, what does one do about such things?
Well, it's perfectly simple. We should also remember those who couldn't march because they didn't have one leg or two legs, or those who were carried away on stretchers and would never walk again. See, we forget those persons. While we're speaking of such things, I want to ask you something that might disturb you. How seriously do you think this is representative of the Bible? Saul has slain his thousands, but David has tens of thousands. Hooray!
Yes.
All right. Now
it is something that disturbs. I said
because you have
day,
said you have said there was no glorification
well,
of war.
Well, what you have, it isn't glorification of war. It is conquest of an enemy, the dangerous Philistine enemy that was always harassing Israel. But there is a touch in it of glee, and then there were. Horrible,
I would say there was more than a touch.
There were horrible things done. You remember the assignment that was given to David. If he used to win the hand of Michal, the daughter of King Saul. He had to slay 100 Philistines and mutilate them, and he slew 200 of them, a good measure. These things are there, and they are part of the tragedy of the time. Yet war as such, I say, and I insist, is not glorified in the Bible. Certain struggles are. Actually, there is, and this recurs to me as being in line with what we had to say about slavery. There is slavery in the Bible admitted, and always a mitigation. And a passage that I quoted from Jeremiah, the first instance of a people abolishing slavery, or trying to abolish slavery, outright in its own midst. We have passages in Deuteronomy. Say this one. When thou comest nigh unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. If it make peace, it shall be tributary unto thee. If it make no peace, thou shalt besiege it. And when the Lord thy God hath delivered it into thy hands, thou shalt smite every male therein by the edge of the sword. But the women and the little ones and the cattle thou shalt keep. But of the cities of these people thou shalt save nothing live, but thou shalt utterly destroy them, the Hittites, the Canaanites, the Amorites, that they teach thee not to do after their abominations. You look at that passage, and unless you take what I have called the corrective attitude of the Bible in its evolutionary aspect, you are completely flattened out by it. But then later on you read in Judges something very relevant to this passage. Now these are the nations which the Lord left to prove Israel by them, even as many as had not known all the wars of Canaan, only that the generation of Israel might know to teach them war. 5 lords of the Philistines, and all the Canaanites and Sidonians and the Hivites. That is to say, God did leave them there, and even though there is a secondary disturbing thought here that was for the purpose of keeping the Israelites on their toes, it was not an outright order. It is modified. Or again, you find the passage, the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, Hittites, and Amorites, and Perizzites, and Hivites, and Jebusites, and they took their daughters to be their wives, and gave their daughters to their sons, and then adds bitterly, and served their gods. Now, if they had done this without serving their gods, the passage would be pointless. Yeah. Because it is the fear of falling into the primitive and savage and brutal superstitions of these peoples that haunted the lawgiver. So that throughout, if you take the context, you see the continuous struggle against the downgoing of that Israelite civilization. Not the intermarriage is condemned as intermarriage, but the defection from the faith. And while I'm on, just let me go on for one minute more. A passage having to do with war. When thou goest forth to war, and thou hast taken captives, and seest among them a beautiful woman, hast a desire unto her, that thou wast have her for thy wife, then shalt thou bring her home to thy house, and she shall shave her head and pare her nails, and she shall put the raiment of her captivity from her, and shall remain in thine house and bewail her father and mother a full month. And after that thou shalt go in unto her and be her husband, and she shall be thy wife. And if it shall be that thou hast no delight in her, then thou shalt let her go whither she will. For thou shalt not sell her at all for money. Thou shalt not make merchandise of her. Mm-hmm. Now, this attitude shows us that what the Israelites were concerned with was not their racial purity with this delusion of something that's in the blood, but with their doctrinal purity and the purity of their civilization. Anyone who wanted to come in a captive from some conquered nation could be taken in and become a Jewess. This is also part of the mitigation of war that I'm speaking of. But there's no glorification of war. How wonderful it is to be a warrior, and how beautiful it is to go and kill and to have the thrill of the battle.
Except in the mind of Job's horse that you spoke of the other day.
Yes.
And of course, well, there's everything in the Bible, which is what makes it the book it is. I would say that the ultimate tribute that we can pay to the Bible, Maurice, as we are considering this theme, not merely the theme of war, which engages us at the moment, but the theme of democracy, the ultimate tribute to pay to the Bible is to say that it has everything in it that is relevant. You speak of an evolution. All right, that evolution is something that we can understand as continuing to operate. It has operated ever since. It operates among all peoples, perhaps. Now, there is the climax, of course, I suppose, for us, of Isaiah's vision, now the time when there shall be no more war at all. We have spoken of that, but how would it be if I read the whole of that famous passage? Or do you think we have read it enough?
No, I don't think so, but I'd like to save it, if you don't mind.
Now, save it for another time?
Save it for... It's such a powerful passage,
yes.
And it's so much around.
All right, but...
Let's keep it for the last discussion.
You don't think we'll forget it?
I hope not.
All right.
What I wanted to go back to was, again, the constant effort to mitigate any warlike spirit. When we are confronted in the modern world with war... there is the frightful danger that the nation that goes out to defend itself becomes so bloodthirsty in its self-defense that it takes on the characteristics of the assaulting the aggressive people. And there are passages in the earliest part of the Bible which militate against this rousing up of a bloodthirsty spirit, turning war into the then... unavoidable evil that it was. Consider this extraordinary passage, again, in the laws given by Moses in his second address to the people, as it were, in his resume of the laws in Deuteronomy. Speaking of the event of war, "And the officers shall speak unto the people, saying, What man is there that has built a house and has not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in battle. Or planted a vineyard and not yet eaten of it. Or betrothed a wife and not yet taken her." And most extraordinary is this. "What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his." I don't know if you've come across any similar calmness in regard to the mobilization of a people done... not with fanfare and with a drowning out of personalities. Not, in other words, thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. I come back to that. But with consideration and with a knowledge of the limitations that should be placed until that time when the human heart will have developed to a point that cannot consider war in that sense or strife in that sense.
What about the fact that Israel today has an army? And,
yes.
And that the men in it are superb fighters, apparently.
Yes.
And proud fighters.
Yes.
And effective fighters.
You know, when
does
I was...
Does that worry you?
Indeed it does. It worries me. I see in it a bloody necessity. When I was a youngster...
A necessity?
Yes, I see a necessity. An unavoidable necessity. When I was a youngster and I came into the Zionist movement around the age of 18, 19... what did I think was going to be the form in which a Jewish homeland, a Jewish state, would emerge? Well, I had a purely, a simplest attitude toward it, and I wasn't the only one. Now, was it only then, say, in 1913, 14, up till 1920, 1921? There's a very strange, fascinating letter in the... archives of all the governments. It's reproduced in Chaim Weizmann's Trial and Error, a letter written by the Emir Faisal by the Emir Faisal, who was then the leading figure of the Arab world. You remember the man who has been apotheosized in the revolt in the desert?
Yes.
A letter from him to Felix Frankfurter, who was then in Paris, working with Weizmann heading the delegation of the Zionist movement to the Allied forces. I'm quoting now from memory, since you raised the subject, but I'm pretty sure this is accurate. Faisal saying that he believes that the building of a Jewish state in Palestine, the Zionist aim, is consonant with Arab interest. He uses the phrase, "We will welcome the Jews back," or "welcome the Jews home." We will work together with them. There is a a consonance between the Zionist outlook and the Arab outlook. In spite of some little difficulties may arise through misrepresentation, we stand for the Arab state. Now, I'm quite certain that this is the spirit of his
letter. Stand for what state?
For the Zionist state.
Yes.
Within the context of Arab freedom. He did add in a rider that if certain concessions were not given to him by the Allied, he would not be responsible for this policy, which was quite intelligible because he was looking for a united liberated Arabia. It never came to pass. That dream that we had, and if I was a simpleton, then some very important men of mature years must be looked upon as simpletons too. Weizmann and Professor, now Justice Felix Frankfurter, and the Emir Faisal, a very shrewd and able man, and lots of Arabs that followed him must all have been very simple.
Yeah.
Here, the tangle of events has made it impossible for us to carry out what we wanted. We longed for a peaceful upbuilding together with the Arabs. We still do. The vast majority of Israelis are, I won't say passive resistors, but they are pacifists at heart.
Mm-hmm.
If we could only get down to the job of doing for the Arabs what Israel, for instance, is now doing in Ghana or in Ethiopia or in Sierra Leone, sending out experts and teaching them how to build a country.
Yes.
But here the situation is a world situation, we might note, in which peace is impossible until there is a universal world order.
Yes, and many of us give much thought to that world order. I have for years, and I know you have, and anyone must. It is so clear to me, as it is clear to others, that the only thing that can cause peace is government. Wars are caused by all the things that are said to cause wars, but it is always the absence of authority, the absence of the power to prevent war, that causes war. If we can imagine a world in which peace is caused and kept the way internal police forces, for instance, keep order within a country or a state or a city, why, we're imagining a great thing. The only trouble is, at present, that we do not know what would happen. Say we got universal and complete disarmament, and I should like to see that happen, and I happen to believe that every living soul on earth desires it, or almost every living soul desires it. Universal and complete disarmament. That is to say, no more weapons of any sort at all. Not merely atomic weapons, but little weapons. Say that happened. How then should we adjudicate? How then might we deal with disputes between nations? You see, formerly, the only way of dealing with a dispute between nations was to have the nations go to war. And it's well known that the only thing that was settled then was which nation was the stronger.
Yes.
No justice was necessarily achieved. One nation got what it wanted because it had as Napoleon said, it had the bigger battalions. There will continue to be arguments and disputes between peoples, between groups of peoples, whether you call them nations or not. The divine thing would be, the almost divine thing would be an order in the world which would be capable of considering those disputes and dealing with them reasonably, which they have never been dealt with.
You've used the word divine.
Well, I said almost divine.
Almost divine, yes, and it's a very significant word. Because that passage that we're going to read in our last talk, we're going to come back to it, it's almost the central passage in all of our meditations on this subject. We'll talk there of God being the one who settles the disputes. So you're almost divine, but you are perfectly right when you say only an international government can do it, which means that only by agreeing to limit some area of authority can governments join in a world government.
By the surrender of certain sovereignties.
Yes, and prudence, the ultimate prudence, which is in itself a wisdom, dictates it. When I was a youngster in England, I keep going back to the old times, I was active in Norman Angel's movement.
Yes.
I wonder if he's remembered now, Norman Angel.
Well, I hope so.
Yes, he got the Nobel Peace Prize. He wrote a book which created a great stir in those days called the Great Illusion. The illusion that war could pay. War does not pay, he said. Even, this was 50 years ago, war doesn't pay. And we know that it doesn't. But that kind of prudence apparently hasn't been enough to keep people from waging war. There was something else at work in them, a combative instinct which overrode prudential considerations.
And the, tragic thing, Maurice, is lighted for me by your reference to the Israeli-Arab dispute. There certainly is ground for dispute there. There are certain interests that conflict. There are certain things that must be resolved. The dream of any man, Israeli or Arab or anything else, the dream of any man would certainly be that sometime in the future there would be a world in which those disputes would be recognized as important, because they are important, very important.
They are tremendously... They should not be made the football either.
That's right.
Of the disputes of other peoples.
That's right.
Do you remember Alfred Nobel's strange dream? He thought that with the development of dynamite, war would become so terrible that peoples would no longer engage in war.
Yes.
Fantastic that a mere thing like dynamite, as we now say miserably, a mere thing like dynamite, should be horrible enough to prevent war when we are on the edge of the ultimate calamity with something that makes dynamite like a toy. It reminds me of a curious joke, the inability of people to realize fundamental realities. I saw a picture of two men carrying an atomic bomb and a girl standing by saying, "Now listen, let those fellows be careful, they're playing with dynamite." But dynamite wasn't good enough to keep from war. And the prudential instincts of man are not sufficient. We're coming down to that ultimate truth that there must be a change of heart,
yes,
as well as prudential wisdom.
And we can have dreams of some great power. It might be us. I'm afraid it won't. I don't know what power it may be. Some power will suddenly, someday resign as a power.
Well, let's keep that for the last of our talks.
That could save the world.
You have just heard The Words We Live By, the 14th in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of democracy and the Bible. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.
Ooh.